We'll just get cracking. There are people still drifting in, so don't let them disturb you or enjoyment of this session that Glenn and Bernie have pulled together. The session is around some work that Glenn has started with correlations on investment returns, and he's going to come up with a few different conclusions. He and I chatted about these last week, and he's got some fairly striking conclusions in some of the areas. So hope you appreciate some of the work that's gone into it. So I'll just give you a very quick bio of Glenn and Bernard, who are our speakers today. We're going to talk for around about 30 minutes, and I'll keep nudging them on time if they're looking like going over. And then we'll have about 15 minutes or so for questions, and then kind of 5 minutes to wrap up and get the hell out of here to the next session. So that's the afternoon's entertainment. My name's John Bayliss. I work for State Super these days. I've been there for all of 6 months, and I'm there doing asset liability management and amongst other things, and so this is critical for organisations like ours. Just quickly introducing Glenn Langton. Glenn's got over 30 years experience, particularly in superannuation consulting, but also with an asset focus. Qualified as an actuary in 1975, probably before some of us were born, and is fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of London as well as Australia. I'll exclude myself from that, by the way. Sorry, Greg. he's worked for a number of Australian firms, Mercer Human Resource Consulting, Coopers Lybrand and Buck Consultants, responsible for the provision of investment services, asset consultant support, and development of investment products for ING Investment Management. Glenn's also played an active role for the Institute during his membership of the Superannuation Employee Benefits Practice Committee, and is currently a member of the Institute's Superannuation Projections and Disclosure Subcommittee. Welcome, Glenn. Bernard Yu has been working with Glenn on this, and has done a lot of the number. He's originally from Brisbane, but came to do his actuarial studies in the University of New South Wales, where my boss is actually a lecturer there, which is quite interesting. He was a co-op scholar under the actuarial stream, completed his Bachelor of Commerce in Actuarial Studies and Financial Economics in 2011, graduating with distinction, it says here. Well done, Bernard. He's worked at Taylor Fry Westpac in their enterprise risk management market risk teams, and also Zurich's pricing team, and currently working as an options trader, I believe, and studying for a certificate in quantitative finance. So one other thing that Glenn asked me to mention is there's a bit of funding for this type of research through the Institute, and he's been able to take advantage of that, which is which gives this type of work its longevity. So without further ado, I'll introduce you to Glenn.
Thanks, John. Welcome this afternoon. As John indicated, that basically this is a joint paper that's been developed by Bernie and myself, just to put this into perspective. Bernie's the bright guy. I have the questions, and he's the bright guy that comes up with these complicated spreadsheets that give me the answers. I think it's a wonderful combination or a working group. As John pointed out, yes, I have been qualified a long time. When I actually did the actual exams, a lot of this esoteric stuff was just not part of our course. So it was very good to work with Bernie. What we did with this was a sort of, let me think, I'll have this thing, hopefully that'll work. Yeah, that because of my background in asset consulting, I spent a lot of time, well, actually, because of my background in superannuation consulting for trustees of superannuation funds who used asset consultants, I sat in front of a lot of asset consultants who would come up with optimized portfolios and sort of I still remember organisations coming up to trustees and saying, we want you to go into alternate asset classes because look at these numbers here. You can actually you do a slightly lower return, but look, the risk is reduced dramatically and your Sharpe ratio has improved dramatically. So your risk return characteristics of this portfolio is much better. So put 20% into infrastructure or private equity, etc. Then, and in particular hedge funds, then the shit hits the fan, as the technical term is used, and suddenly they find that all of the, a number of the assumptions that they've actually used in coming up with that optimised portfolio just don't work. So basically, out of that, and there's been a lot of work being done on this whole question of correlations, I felt that there was a need to look at this afresh. And the first thing I wanted to do is do there's lots of work on this, is just to actually prove that correlations do change over time. So the assumption that you can go in and optimise on the basis of fixed correlations is just a rubbish, right? But the second thing, and it's interesting, out of that, and this was more like mischance or sort of, we didn't actually start off this, we came up with a whole new way of looking at how returns are generated and the implications of those returns in terms of correlations. And so we've actually split up the change in the value of assets into a risk component and an interest component. And we actually analysed how those two components and correlations with the share market worked over time. And in my paper, those that happen to have read it, you'll notice that this is a work in progress. It's very much, we've started the process. We've only done this for fixed interest and shares at this stage, but my feeling is I want to do this for particularly the alternate classes where supposedly you get diversification benefits, even though there's a lower return. And I'd be interested to honestly see what the results are, but getting data for that's very hard. One of the things we've also done, and this is some work that Bernie's done, that I sort of peer-reviewed, shall we say, is how do we use what we've done to actually model portfolios? Because then this takes us to the final thing, is that if you can't have a portfolio of assets that gives you diversification in all circumstances, what are the implications for managing a portfolio of assets? So, as I've said, modern portfolio theory, everyone thought this was a great thing. Very much a lot of question marks about that whole, the fundamentals of it now, and so there's a number of different theories that have been put forward. That one of the things that assumes is constant returns and correlations and risks, the important thing, and I still think trustees still think this, is that they have a portfolio of assets, and there are diversification benefits associated with these portfolios, which are spurious, and that don't actually exist at the very time that they want to have diversification benefits. And as I said, history has demonstrated that exactly the time when you want to have those diversification benefits, some of the asset classes that you're invested in, the diversification benefits disappear. So, as I said, our objectives of this research was just to see how correlations changed over time, to investigate why they changed over time, to look at a different way of modelling, and then talk about, and this is more future research, how we can actually use this information to help trustees actually model their manage their portfolios. So the first hypothesis that we put forward was that basically asset class prices change over time. Now, just as a sort of a proviso, you'll notice I'm talking about asset class prices. We're not talking about returns. With the information we had, it was easy to actually model changes in prices. Returns, we didn't have the data. We couldn't get the data we wanted. So we wanted to say these correlations change over time as risk changes. Now, the first step you've got to do is how do we assess market risk? And we decided that the way to assess market risk was actually to pick the risk premium in junk bonds. right? And the assumption is that as the risk premium in a junk bond goes up, that's the market's assessment of the chances of that of companies going broke increases, and therefore that's a pseudo assessment of the risk, the market's assessment of the amount of risk in a market. So the first thing to do is how do we actually split up our data into risky periods and lower risky periods, and we've used the risk premium in junk bonds as that sort of differentiator. Then what we did was we calculated the internal rate of return in junk bonds, American junk bonds. We calculated the yield on comparable government bonds, and the difference between the two was the risk premium. We did that for AAA bonds as well, because we wanted to see, and you'll see the analysis, to look at how two different asset classes actually were correlated to share markets. Yes?
Is that a prospective calculation of the IRR?
Prospective...
In the sense that you're looking at the level of market risk now or the level of market risk that actually...
It was looking at the return, that the market value of the junk bond, right? It was looking at the coupon, the future coupon rate. It was looking at the duration and in working out a prospective yield at a particular point of time. It was the future. It was basically the assessment of the risk premium at that particular time.
I think that was one of the biggest struggles that we had.
You had to assume a default rate because the yield on a junk bond includes compensation for the default rate, so you need to take that out.
No, because again, that's all part of the. Again, remember, it's all this is our assessment of the market's assessment of the riskiness in the market. It's nothing more sophisticated than that. And clearly, if the market says that there's a higher, if a proportion of that risk premium is default, which obviously it is, the higher that, All right. So, and then what we did was we actually calculated the correlations with the changes in the price of the S&P 500 for different levels of risk. And as I said, we're only looking at price. So these are the results, and I'm skipping through these because I'm scared of John. That basically what we did was we split the risk levels into sort of the bottom 75% and the top 25%, and then worked out what the correlations for AAA, which is good quality corporate bonds, and CAA, which is junk bonds, with movements in the share price. Right, so that the important things that came out of this were that you can see, particularly for junk bonds, as the level of risk changes, the correlations change dramatically. And I had to get my head around this. Remember, this is the correlations between changes in the yield to the changes in the price of the shares. Right, so what happens with junk bonds is that during high risk periods, the correlation between those two things gets more negative. Now, what that means is that as the yield on junk bonds goes up, right, that the share prices go down. So negatively correlated. So effective, and that makes sense. That clearly, as the market assesses there's more risk in the market, right, that you expect that share prices will go down. So what we've got now, the interesting thing is you can see with corporate bonds, good quality corporate bonds, even though it does go up, it doesn't go up by anywhere near as much, which again, a lot of this stuff, I like it because it's intuitively right, you know. The other things that you come out of this is that you actually look at the correlations during lower risk periods, and if you look at overall, you can see that the correlations between the good quality corporate bond and the junk bond are very similar. So that anyone that was actually basing their correlations on what happened over the pre-GFC, which was typically a sort of a lower risk period, would end up with correlations that were more like the lower risk period, or if they were basing their correlations on the total, they end up with correlations that, you know, you could say, oh, look, the junk bond and the good quality corporate bond have similar sort of correlations. So what we'll do, look at the junk bond returns an extra 3%. Okay, so you should take some money, some of your money out of your good quality corporates and put it into junk bonds. And then surprise, surprise, we get to a period of high risk and the correlations get blown out of the water. So what we felt was that fairly clearly demonstrates what everybody knows, but it gives us a good feel for why. Hypothesis two, this was the more interesting thing, and I'm not sure whether how new this is, but I haven't actually been able to find any literature that explores this, and anyone who has seen any literature, I'd be very pleased to be told about it. But basically, we said that the change in market price of an asset comprises the two components, a component based on changes in the risk-free rate and changes in the risk premium. Right, so basically there's an interest effect, right, and there's a risk premium effect. And what we wanted to do is find out how the correlations actually moved in these two components of market price movements over time and risk. Now, what's exciting about this, what we found exciting about this, is that clearly the way that an asset class's correlation with movements in the share price vary over time is a function of how the components, those two components, actually exist in the price. So this is a very simplistic graph, but just to bring this home, sort of, if you look at investment one, the blue is the interest effect and the orange is the risk effect. Investment two. So in investment one, all of the price movements are going to be driven by interest rate effect, right? Whereas with investment two, the risk effect has a big bearing on the actual way that the market price will vary over time. So if you then want to look at the correlations between those price movements over time, clearly the correlations of the interest effect with investment one is going to drive it. With investment two, you've got to actually take into account the correlations between the risk effect and the interest effect, and that will have a much bigger impact on what happens. So if we then look at our results, the interesting things that came out of this were that if you look at the risk effect, you can see it gets more negative, regardless of which asset class, right? So the risk effect is more negative, and why I explained before, that makes sense. As the risk component gets riskier, share prices go down. The interest effect, but it's negative. The interest effect is actually positive. The correlations are positive. And again, trying to think about that from just intuitively, that what does that mean? That during high periods of risk, interest rates tend to go down. Right? But, you know, what happens is when you have economic disasters, the government reduces interest rates, so interest rates go down and share prices go down. So are we surprised? You know, as expected, you'd expect the correlations of the interest effect to be actually positive, whereas the risk effect is negative. Again, the...
Is that a flight to quality kind of issue? Is it people going to less risky assets?
The driver, what that does is it means that the risk premium that they demand for risky assets goes up. So effectively, one of the reasons that junk bonds, the actual yield in junk bonds goes up dramatically during periods of stress, is that no one wants to buy them. right? So they're right, they go and buy government bonds. But so people still there, particularly in those circumstances, you have stress sales, and the only way that they can actually sell these damn things is to give such a huge risk premium that people say, I've got to have it, you know. And do you look at the return? There was 30% returns during the worst times. You could actually get a 30% return on junk bonds. Now, as Frank has said, I suspect that there's a significant component for that for default. So this, again, we feel proved hypothesis too, that the risk effect and the interest effect are very important components of the returns. And during periods of high risk, they actually change dramatically. What we did, as I said, we expect this to apply to other asset classes, and it's going to be, I'm going to be very interested if we can see what the implications are for infrastructure, for the alternate asset class, where there are supposedly diversification benefits but lower returns, whether those diversification benefits are illusionary. I mean, one of the problems with the unlisted assets is that they get valued on an irregular basis, and at best you've got a stale pricing issue. Right, so there's work to be done there, but that's something we're going to do in future. I'm going to hand over to Bernie now, and he has taken what we've done there and sort of looked at how we can actually use this information to model what's going to happen in terms of asset classes.
Hello. I think just a note on the note of stale pricing, that's actually when John Evans and Glenn actually came to me and said, we need a research assistant position. We wanted to actually look at alternative assets, and could you please have a look at this stale pricing thing, because we think that it affects correlation, and why people see diversification benefit is because things are stalely priced versus an efficient market. Of course, you're going to see a lot of diversification benefit because one thing doesn't move, the other one's constantly whipping around. So from there, we took this idea that, okay, what happens if we have a risk component and a risk-free component? How do they drive things? And so the idea of correlations moving came from there. With regards to modelling the asset returns, I think the gentleman over there touched upon it at the beginning. I think getting the terminology right was quite difficult. When we looked at the two classes of equities and fixed income, we kind of had to break down the conventional ways of thinking about premium. When you look at equity risk premium, what is it? You look at what the thing returned over, the past year. You look at, the change in price, add on dividends, etc. And then you look at, what you would have returned in your bank account and whatnot, and take the difference. It's very retrospective. Whereas you look at a bond risk premium, what is that? That is the difference between what you will get if you invest in the bond for the next year over what you would have gotten or what you will get in the government, kind of thing. So I had to kind of look at how to, make the model consistent. How can we look at something that is both forward-looking in terms of the bonds and backward-looking in the equities, and how can we compromise and fiddle around with that? In terms of actually backtesting, what we decided to do was settle on looking at price only. You look at junk bonds, we do not factor in the coupons that you get out. We do not look at default payments. If we done this analysis on the current European crisis, it would have been very different. You're talking about countries defaulting on their coupon payments, let alone, making repayments into their principal and things like that. So I want to foreshadow that this is really an exercise on price, because given the limited data that we had, this is what we could do. So in terms of modelling the equity returns, the asset returns, we've actually modelled the returns, the historical returns on the equities, and the historical yields on the bonds. That's what we've done. I mean, you can assume a proxy between the yields on the bonds and the actual return you would get. Of course, you have to factor in the coupons and also the actual defaulting on these coupons. But there is a relationship. We can look at duration, etc. So I've tried to make it a little bit more diagrammatic, the model. we heard in the 2007 global financial crisis that one of the actuaries was responsible for the way that banks priced their CDOs, you know, the infamous Gaussian copula. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with that concept, but essentially it says that the body, they move together in a certain correlation, the tails become independent. That's what the Gaussian copula does. It's essentially a funny mechanism that says this random variable moves in a way that another random variable should move as well. So it's a multivariate distribution. What we tried to do was break that down and look at it from a more simplistic point of view. Instead of having two components just moving independently, changing throughout time, what we decided to do was look at hypothesis two. And that was the correlations will change if some exogenous factor changes, that is the level of market risk. So what we did was we said, okay, both asset classes, or when we extrapolate to multidimensional assets, are all driven by a fundamental risk-free rate. This is the common component. Then what we will do is we will have a correlation in good times and a correlation in bad times. And what good and bad is determined by is that by this exogenous factor, by the level of market risk. So, for example, when we did the modelling, we looked at the risk premium in junk bonds. And then what we did was we looked at equity risk premium and the bond risk premium. Again, this is the equity risk premium as we know it in the historical return, what you would return in excess, and this is looking at the yield. Again, it's not, I want to be very clear that this isn't consistent. You have to do another step in the sense that you have to convert these yields into bond prices and then you can get bond returns. But for simplicity, I just wanted to make clear that this is roughly what our model is doing. It's looking at two asset classes sharing the same component. Any questions so far? Yep.
I'm getting flashbacks to some episodes in 2009 mm-hmm. where we wanted to move corporate bonds, basically use corporate bonds to make specie transfers to insurance companies to take the ventures of defined benefit pension liabilities. Mm-hmm. And it's always, there was a screen price for them, but you could never actually ship them at the screen price. It's like, oh, you want to actually trade them? No, the price is different.
Oh, yeah.
So just wondering, is that something that you were able to pick up in your modelling of the prices and yields?
Well, I mean, we don't assume that we go to market with these prices. I mean, for a large defined benefit fund in, say, Europe, they'd have had a very hard time in, as you said, you know, trying to get these bonds and getting these yields. So therefore, they would have pushed the prices and would have pushed the prices against them. So no, we do not factor that in. We do not factor liquidity of the market in getting these returns.
Okay. Can I say that in terms of market risk, we believe that the risk premium on junk bonds is fundamentally affected by liquidity risk, right? So part, as I was answering Frank, part of the reason that the actual margin was so high is because no one was buying, right? So that's driven by liquidity because there was a lack of buyers, right? So you know, I think implicit in the market yield, the market risk is liquidity.
And I thought that was a very neat way of picking it up. I guess the point I'd be making is it's actually even more messy than it looks because of the sort of actual price if you're trading, even, I mean, it doesn't need to be huge. I mean, even
a couple of bips would move it a lot, yeah. Yeah.
And again,
but it depends what your data source was.
Bloomberg.
Yeah. And again, I think, remember what we're doing there was we're just taking the top 25%. So it doesn't matter whether it was 30% yield or 35% yield or, you know, sort of, again, I think that the top 20, it probably wouldn't have changed the top 25% more because we were just trying to differentiate between high risk and low risk. You know, and so I agree, I wouldn't want to put my hand up and sort of pick any particular number and sort of put my house on a particular number. But I think that the 25% split is probably close to the mark.
Just two technical questions. What's the period of time that you're using for a unit that you're measuring correlation over, is it month to month?
Month to month, yes.
Month to month.
Yes.
And the data, what time was the data? Really?
The data...
20 years, okay.
Yep.
Up till 2008.
Yep.
2008, so
yep.
Well into the crisis.
Yep. So, yeah, which leads on to, in terms of actually modelling, what we started with was the univariate distribution, so the distribution of returns for each asset class. Unfortunately, we didn't get the time to combine them into a portfolio that would be, you know, an industry benchmark. But what we wanted to make sure was that we were actually modelling the individual components correctly. Now, what we did was... with these three components, we assumed that they had the same distribution in the sense that we tried not to be too clever with, you know, putting in like a T distribution here and having a gamma distribution there and a log normal. We just tried to keep everything the same in that sense, but you had to change the parameters with respect to each component. So as you can see, we chose the skew normal distribution, which allows us to capture any bit of like the downside risk in the equity returns, as you'll see in the next slide. What we did was we used that skew normal distribution, which allowed us to capture the left tail and also the right tail. Now, while that graph looks quite nice, as we can see here, the government bond yields... we didn't manage to grab the skew as much as we would like to. The reason...
No, I'm just looking at it.
Yep, okay. The reason we feel that we haven't captured the skew of this distribution as nicely as we would in equity returns is just because the period of the data. We ended the data right in the middle of the financial crisis. A lot of this, these clumps here, was when the interest rate had been coming off and they just bulked down in the middle. Kind of thing. That's the empirical reasoning for the data. I mean, we could have been a little bit more fancy and instead of chosen a skew normal distribution, use something with slightly more skewness. But again, we tried to keep things as consistent as possible just by keeping with the same distribution. Again, what this graph is, the black line represents the theoretical empirical distribution which the returns are derived from, and same thing with the yields of the government bonds. And the blue line is the data, and a red line is just a sample, just a Monte Carlo sample. In terms of portfolio construction, this is an ongoing work in progress. How do we combine these two? How do we look at the value at risk? How do we look at the conditional value at risk? How can we explain these to investors that your 1 in 20 year loss is actually more likely to be 5% than 6% or something like that, or the other way around? How can we better explain to trustees what the actual risks of a portfolio will be in a downturn or in a stable market, or what I believe we're currently in a bull market? So it's working on that, how to balance that, how do we use these two asset classes, how can we use the fact that they're constantly driven by interest rates to hedge our portfolios. Do we actually need to invest more in the risk-free component of these portfolios to actually hedge the risks? That's something that's ongoing and that we need to look at. I think...
Do you think, if you look at... There are investment managers around the world that are building multi-asset portfolios that are taking a lot of this theory and putting it into practice. Do you think the big issue for Australia in particular is that not being a defined benefit market and having very sort of DC orientated, buyer silos, buyer balance fund, buyer thing, you know, that's going to make it very difficult for Australia to be able to take advantage of this type of new research and new way of thinking about portfolio?
Well, I suppose the first thing is that I don't think there's any real difference between defined benefit and accumulation in this context because companies have to take the defined benefit, they have to actually mark the net liability in their accounts.
Yeah, no, but the difference is that in a defined contribution scheme, you've got to define to the client exactly what they're buying.
Yep.
You have silos where you've got an Australian equity portfolio manager, an international equity portfolio manager, a fixed interest portfolio manager, all probably taking the same credit risks. So it is a very different market in that respect, opposed to the CEO DB model, where they might outsource to a number of providers of these types of solutions. Where in Australia, they tend
I'm not actually sure that you're right. I think that the CFO of a company that has a massive defined benefit arrangement, he wants to know as much as the individual wants to know what's going to happen to his risk return of his portfolio. I would suggest that the CFO, he needs to know what this portfolio is going to do.
The CFO will outsource it, whereas a investment team won't.
In Australia, let me assure you, they outsource to the asset consultants.
Yeah.
Okay, can I just...
We're getting very tight on time, guys, so
can I just finish off?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let me just finish off. John's about to hit me. So can I just say where this has led me to say is that you can establish, and I think sort of part of the answer to your question is that trustees in Australia, because they actually have to specify a risk return characteristics of every investment portfolio, and you know, with the dashboard coming up, it's even more in your face. So basically all you can do is you can actually define the risk return characteristics of a portfolio, assuming that all the assets are at fair value, right? However, as we know, as we go through the economic cycle, those asset classes are rarely at fair value. And so what we're suggesting is that what trustees will need to do is they'll basically need to stress test their portfolios to see what the level of risk is with those portfolios, and in the context and use the modelling that we're doing, because our modelling allows you to factor in different levels of correlation as on the assumption of different levels of risk. The other thing that we're suggesting is that how do you actually stress test? And we believe, and Bernie mentioned it, sort of alluded to, we think that you need to start to look at VAR and CVAR. I'm not sure. I suspect most of you have come across VAR. But I don't believe that tells you much at all. CVAR, which is conditional VAR, basically is a much more instructive number, because what that does is it tells you what the average loss is below 5%. If you actually, you know, you've got a 5% chance of getting below minus 10%, then on average it's expected to be minus 15%. And that's more, it's much more instructive. So I think, that's the end. So
on your paper, just two questions. One, you left out the GFC, although somewhere in the paper you said that the data went to September 2011, or was it definitely 2008? All your data?
In terms of backtesting and then fitting the parameters, it went to...
There's a different. You've got to differentiate between the analysis of what we did, the hypothesis one testing, and our modelling testing, because we backtested. Right. The model was backtested back to 2000. You know, sort of tested against returns back to 2008, but the actual hypothesis one was. Right. This was a different period.
Well, for the second question on the correlations, when you define your 75 percentile risk periods, aren't you creating bias there? Because the actual the measurement, your definition is actually going to be the adverse periods in where you're categorising the risk period. So you're obviously going to have a bigger correlation on the higher risk.
You've got to be more subtle.
Are you saying...
Using the same, what you're measuring is the same way you're categorising your data. It's the change in the junk bond yield that's affecting the data. Yeah. Is how you're measuring it.
It probably won't change the results. It'll change the numbers, but the results are intuitive and they're well known.
What we're doing is... is looking at, so during the question is, okay, during the period, what do the correlations do? I accept that we're, you know, particularly the hypothesis one, we're looking at junk bonds and we're saying this is a high, you
yeah,
know.
You're saying in rising junk bond yields, do junk bonds rise fast? Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Obviously, by definition, because that's how you pick the data. And yeah. To me, it's, you're biasing, you're skewing the results.
Well, we accept, well, then the only sort of the only criticism you can make of it, I suggest, is that you're saying that the risk premium in junk bonds is not a fair indicator of market risk.
No, because you're measuring. Yeah, what I'm saying
is the fact that you say it's in the top 25% by looking at the whole database, whereas at that particular point of time, it's not necessarily in the top 25% looking post hoc. So you're actually, it's not a proper backtest. It doesn't take long to actually fix it up.
Okay, guys, we've got about 5 minutes for any further questions. I've been a bit slack in not asking anybody to speak into the microphone and say their name, but from now on, can we do that? So are you happy to take questions?
Oh, yeah. Well, questions I'd be obviously happy to take questions.
Okay, obviously there's some some good questions coming through in terms of the nature of the analysis and what the conclusions are, so keep them flowing.
Okay, Frank Ash, independent consultant, and also with Macquarie Uni Applied Finance Centre. Is this thing working?
You're working?
Yeah.
Yep.
Some of this stuff here, I mean, you said that, you know, part of this is pushing back against the asset consultants who say this sort of thing. But we've been pushing back against the asset consultants using this sort of analysis, you know, the sort you're aiming against, for the last 20 years. And there is a huge amount of inertia, especially within some asset consultants. Certainly, as the gentleman over there said, there are many worldwide asset managers who are looking at this sort of stuff and taking it into account some of the concepts of copulas and that actually into their work, and also taking a look at ways in which doing essentially what you're doing, which is projecting, you know, trying to actually estimate what the correlation is going to be in certain time periods. But there's one other fundamental problem that we have with the analysis that you're doing, and that is one that we come across all the time when we're looking at alternative assets, especially property. And we go right back to the early 1990s where National Mutual, which some people here might remember, National Mutual put together a low volatility fund which had a whole bucket load of property in there because property had low volatility and low correlation with everything else. And this was just at the beginning of a long drop in property prices. What they hadn't noticed and what is still a problem with the sort of analysis that you're doing is that we actually have to tie the period of measurement that we're using, the period at which we're looking for the correlation, to be consistent with the time period over which the asset allocator is going to make changes to the portfolio. So if the asset allocator is going to make large monthly changes, then it's relevant to look at returns and interest rate changes on a month-by-month basis. If you're doing it on a day-by-day basis, that's a hedge fund sort of analysis. You have to look at daily correlations. But the typical fund that we're talking about looks at these sorts of things on a three-year basis, in which case you have to say, well, how is the three-year change in equity prices correlate with a three-year change? Now we have to actually look at total return for junk bonds and the like, because that is the asset allocation that the investors of the portfolio are going to feel. That's the correlations they're going to feel, because people don't actually make changes of the asset allocation on that month-by-month basis. They might at the edge, but the bulk of the portfolio is going to be driven by the strategic asset allocation.
I'm conscious of running out of time, and I do want to answer that. In fact, I don't agree with your statement that increasingly there's an acceptance. Well, because that step one is the reason that there has been a reluctance to accept moving with moving asset classes with an assessment of what's happening is that basically there's been a long history of organisations providing dynamic asset allocation advice, TAA advice, that have in fact proven they've added no value. Right. So that the problem is that in terms of monthly movements, there's a long history of organisations selling a consulting service for that and failing. Right. So you've got also a major. But what has happened is there's an increasing acceptance of dynamic asset allocation, which is actually moving asset allocation on a 12-month, you know, sort of on an irregular basis when they believe that markets are overvalued or undervalued. And clearly that's what's actually happening in our market over GFC, i.e. they were concerned about where the markets were, they increased their cash holding, reduced their shareholding. So basically that the trustees don't take a three-year view, they take a sort of a 12-month strategic view, but it's very much appointed. So that I think that we need to have a means of providing trustees with the ability to decide how they should move away from their strategic asset allocation, because they want to. I mean, when the market was 7,000, that there was that was a point where even if you thought the market was going to go up, that there was a point there where you could have decided, I want to take profits. I mean, I'm going to lock in the huge returns we've had. So we need to give them a mechanism of determining how their portfolio will react if certain things happen, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Yep. John Bayliss, State Super. I represent some trustees, and they're definitely moving away from a three-year cycle towards a much more dynamic process of reviewing their asset allocation. There is a dynamic asset allocation process which moves much more regularly in that.
And if that is the case, then I agree that this sort of analysis is necessary. But you still have to say that I'm going to actually shift the majority of my portfolio for this to actually be worthwhile and get the commitment from the trustee that after 3 years, when it didn't work, like we had going up to the... up in the tech bubble, that they're not going to say, this process is crap. 3 years ago you told me we were in a bubble and we got out, and now it's still going up, and they got out at the top.
There's definitely an education process where one of the problems about getting out is you always get out before the top occurs, by definition, right, so that you give up something. But if you earn, again, my view is that if you can demonstrate to a trustee they've earned 15% per annum and instead of 16% per annum, then that's great, because what you've done is you've actually protected them. And instead of earning minus 5%, they've earned 0%. And that's the nature of the assignment.
Okay, good questions. One last question, if anybody's got one. Going? Oh, yep. The hand up, the guy behind you, please.
Eddie Brennan from Taylor Watson. First question is very, very simple. When you defined your risk proxy, it was the difference between corporates and treasuries. What sort of duration were you looking at, and how would your conclusions change if you looked at a longer or shorter duration for that? Second one is again about that risk proxy. As I understand it, you're breaking down correlations with equity movements into the interest and the credit component, if you like.
Risk, because
risk is being represented.
Because I mean,
have you considered the then correlation between interest and credit or your proxy for risk, to the extent that they may be moving in parallel as well, and how does that then affect the third factor that you're looking at?
So let's see the first question in terms of duration.
We looked at 1, 2, and 3 years. And for the first year, well, they got less sensitive. Like, the correlations were closer to zero as you went out.
Okay. The reason I ask is that for the investors that we're looking at, they might be interested in different durations, quite possibly different risks in the portfolios.
I think that what if we did this analysis for say term deposits, right? Then I think you'll find that the risky component of it will be virtually nil, and the risk free component will be all of it. So I think if you think about that graph that we did, where the combinations of the two become relevant. So the shorter you go in fixed interest, the lower the risky component, and the higher the interest impact, and the correlations will reflect that. So my feeling is that term deposits are a diversifier. You know, they're a real diversifier. I mean, a government bond is a real diversifier. It's only when you get to a fixed interest investment that has a massive risk component that it's not a diversifier during bad periods. And so the second part of that question was correlations.
So you're using two explanatory variables to look at correlations with the third, but I'm saying there's probably...
The correlation between the risk component, the risky component, and the interest component. No, we didn't look at that. But I'm just wondering if you can think. Basically, because what we were looking at is the correlations with the movements in share prices. It'd be something else we could look at, but we didn't look at that. All right.
Okay. Thanks very much, guys. Can you join me in thanking Glenn and Bernard for their work? And I just have a small token of appreciation.